Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. This edition begins a three-part series about how determined, fact-driven, civil public protest of a government plan to incinerate chemical weapons in Madison County, Kentucky, went from a NIMBY, not in my backyard, point of view, to NOPE, not on planet Earth. People from across political and ideological spectrums, from Richmond to Russia, brought together by and overcoming a common threat, an effort that meant fighting the world's mightiest power, the Pentagon, and succeeding. People like Peter Hilly and Craig Williams.
I was just minding my own business building kitchen cabinets, and Craig Williams and I were working together at Walker Woodworks and talking daily, and he had been to the first meeting that the Army had about the chemical weapons.
They announced to the community that there were weapons of mass destruction stored at that depot and that they planned to incinerate them. And were there any questions?
So what exactly are we talking about here? Peter Hilly.
These weapons were aging. They're very dangerous. The M55 rocket has got 10 pounds of nerve agent in it, and this is some of the deadliest stuff ever produced. A drop the size of the head of a pin on your skin will kill a healthy adult male in 3 minutes. It's extremely lethal. There's 10 pounds of that nerve agent in each one of these rockets. Now, that would be bad enough, but alongside of that, there's the rocket motor, which is potentially explosive. There's the igniter for the rocket motor, which is potentially explosive. There's the burster that is intended to explode when the rocket reaches its target and disperse the agent in those lethal droplets. That's explosive, and there's a fuse on the burster. So you've got multiple potentially combustible or explosive components in one 6-foot-long rocket along with 10 pounds of nerve agent and no drain plug. These were designed without a drain plug. They were designed to be fired and used. So it was a very problematic. We had our stockpile largely consisted of thousands of those M55 rockets.
Our thanks to Ben Evans for permitting us to include in the telling of this story excerpts from his 2015 documentary, Nerve, and we posted a link on eswEKU.org. Former State Representative Harry Moberly was at that initial meeting hosted by the Army in 1984.
They came in and told us they were going to incinerate the stockpile. And they didn't expect to see what was obviously some opposition to that, even at the first meeting.
At least give us a little better chance of staying alive.
Craig Williams rose to put the U.S. Army on notice.
You're going to find a lot of people back in the streets, not in Washington, but right here in Madison County, and joined by people in the surrounding counties, and the power of the people, like it did in the Philippines and like it did in the Vietnam War, will once again surfaced, and we'll put a stop to it. Thank you.
And on the way home from that first meeting, my wife said to me,
someone has to do something about this because this can't be.
And so since I always do what my wife tells me, 30 years later, here I am still working on the issue and trying to make it as safe as possible.
Peter Hilly.
We had to begin to think outside the box and say, you know, there must be a better way than incinerators to get rid of this agent, and it turned out there was.
The story of getting rid of the chemical weapons at Bluegrass Army Depot in Madison County spans generations, including those in leadership today, Richmond Mayor Robert Blythe and Madison County Judge Executive Reagan Taylor.
My daddy worked there back in the late 40s and the early 50s and 60s. He and a brother of his were ammunition handlers after the war.
I think anybody that many generations back that grew up in Madison County, I think the Army's always been a big part of our community. My grandfather back in the mid-40s was a firefighter out at the Bluegrass Army Depot.
VX, GB, and mustard agent had been stored in bunkers for decades. The mustard agent was destroyed in 2021. They got rid of the VX in 22. If you live in our area, you know this, but if you're just passing through or maybe you're new here, here's what we're talking about. The Bluegrass Army Depot, all 14,000 plus acres, 225 acres dedicated to chemical arms storage, is situated just a few miles from Richmond, Berea, and Waco in Madison County. About 35 miles to the north is Lexington and Fayette County. About 600,000 people live in the region. The wind doesn't respect county lines. The U.S. Army has stored 523 tons of chemical weapons at the depot since the 1940s. Just last month, the disposal of these weapons finally concluded. This is a very complex story, one that WEKU's Stu Johnson has been covering since that first revelatory meeting in 1984.
The actual destruction of nerve and mustard agent took place over a relatively short period of time, 4 years, ending last month. But a key part of the story goes back to a February 1984 meeting in Madison County when Army officials proposed incinerating the stockpile. Berea's Craig Williams, who became what could fairly be characterized as the leader of the opposition, attended the meeting. The idea of burning chemical weapons brought questions.
And somebody asked, what are the emissions that come out of the stack? And they said, well, it's just carbon monoxide and water vapor. And we all just kind of looked at each other and thought, how could that be? How can you incinerate the most toxic chemicals on the planet and only have water vapor and carbon monoxide come out of the stack?
Initial community reaction quickly turned into an organized effort through concerned citizens of Madison County, founded in part by Richmond author Braceland Flood. Flood passed away a decade ago. His wife Kathy was also very active in the organization. She remembers the Army first suggested a generic environmental assessment that was not site-specific.
So things like Hartmore Middle School, Eastern Kentucky University, the hospital, and an industrial park, all of which were nearby, were not calculated into the computations about, you know, dangers and risks and stuff.
Flood says a previous incident where smoke pots were burned one night at the depot, resulting in a smoky haze hovering near the ground and some hospitalizations and traffic stops on the interstate, didn't help to bolster confidence, especially since there wasn't quick responsibility taken by the Army. The concerned citizens group grew in size and makeup after that first public meeting at the depot. Flood says Oris Blackwell, an environmental science professor at Eastern Kentucky University, and John Meisenheimer, who taught organic chemistry at Eastern, were important contributors.
I think it gave us more credibility. I mean, you know, Braceland was a writer, and I was a retired bank exec, and I didn't really have the credentials to mount an effective offense against incineration. But Dr. Meisenheimer and Dr. Blackwell did have that background.
The whole idea of disposal, no matter the method, brought worries that an accident might lead to a major threat to human life and even evacuations. At some point, the idea of trucking it out to another disposal site was broached. But that didn't go over well with the community, or, as Tom Fitzgerald with Kentucky Resources Council says, with many in Congress.
The rest of Congress was more than happy to let the eight communities where this stuff was located deal with that problem themselves, because they very quickly passed restrictions saying, you ain't moving that stuff through my district, right? So we knew that we're going to deal with it in place.
Kathy Flood emphasized the important role former Central Kentucky Congressman Larry Hopkins and his aide Robert Rangel played in convincing the Army to move away from burning the weapons. Eight military sites around the country had chemical weapon stockpiles. In the end, half still went with an incineration method, so it was an issue in Congress, but the matter came before Kentucky lawmakers, too. Tom Fitzgerald went to Frankfort, asking state lawmakers to classify nerve and mustard agents as hazardous waste. That would up the bar for the Army.
It's, you know, Kentucky doesn't generally go beyond the federal minimum in terms of our setting bars for regulatory responsibility. But in this case, the legislature did that overwhelmingly. And that was one of the pieces of the puzzle that caused the Army to reconsider using incineration as a technology.
And so then came the formal search for an alternative to burning chemical weapons in Madison County. Fitzgerald remembers lots of consultants bringing forward proposals. Over time, much time, with extensions on deadlines and additional appropriations in Congress approved, the ultimate decision was made to neutralize nerve munitions and place mustard agent rockets and projectiles in a static detonation chamber. And so that got going in 2019 and ended on July 7th of this year. The sounds just outside the Bluegrass Army Depot main gate after completion of the formal chemical weapons destruction campaigns. Just down the road is the Battlefield Golf Course. This day found retired Army veteran Doug Upton after his round. He came to the area just 2 years ago, but is certainly familiar with the chemical weapons issue.
And frankly, we never should have had them. That humanity would bring itself to this point where we feel that that was a necessary weapon is really horrific, just like the A-bomb. And look what we've done to ourselves. Look what we've done to ourselves as a civilization.
But the weapons were made and then stored in more than 900 bunkered igloos on the Madison County Army installation, until some 1,500 workers at the depot spent thousands of hours ridding Kentucky of chemical weapons. In so doing, Kentucky became the last site in the U.S. to complete formal demilitarization. And with that, it became a global accomplishment in meeting an International Chemical Weapons Convention agreement. Now the focus is on dealing with residual agent in drained warheads, decontamination, and eventually dismantling of facilities. I'm Stu Johnson for Eastern Standard.
Back to those early days. The momentum was building behind a coordinated citizens' pushback against incinerating nerve agents. People rose above politics. On one hand, you had Williams, a Vietnam War veteran and registered Democrat.
With a $6 billion budget against our $400 or $500 expense account, we realize that you can hire more lawyers, get more studies, and pay more experts. But what you can't get is thousands of Kentuckians to support your plan to build this plant. That is the one thing we've got that you can't get. And the people's will prevail, and we will stop this incinerator.
And on the other hand, respected author, journalist, and Republican Braceland Flood.
It's very important that the people of Central Kentucky get a chance to tell the Army how they feel about being double-crossed.
The Army's fixation on the initial deadline for destroying the weapons was taken before state legislators in Frankfort by environmental attorney Tom Fitzgerald.
The result of this preoccupation is that the public safety, health, and environmental concerns have become secondary.
Fitzgerald, Williams, and others wrote and proposed a state statute, and in 1988, the Kentucky General Assembly took decisive bipartisan action on chemical weapons disposal and waste treatment. The legislation passed in that session and signed by then-Governor Wallace Wilkinson states, "The Commonwealth of Kentucky owes to its residents a duty of utmost care to assure that no person will be exposed to these compounds or the degradation byproducts of these compounds through purposeful or accidental release of the compounds into the air, land, or water of the Commonwealth, and also owes a duty to utilize the police powers of the Commonwealth to guarantee the safe demilitarization, decommissioning, dismantling, and disposal of weapons containing these compounds, and to eliminate potential risks of exposure from the treatment and disposal of the compounds." This forced a search for alternative safe methods of disposal. And in 1991, the Chemical Weapons Working Group, which had been formed as the formal representative of citizens at stockpile sites in the U.S., the Pacific, and Russia, released a technical document generated by a collaboration of scientists who had been working on alternatives to incineration.
Once we had this report that demonstrated there were viable ways of doing this without combustion, that began the next chapter of selling that idea both to the scientific community as well as the political community in Washington.
Craig Williams was in the hearing room on Capitol Hill in Washington when the issue reached a pivotal moment.
When the general was testifying that ran the program at the time, and the chairman asked him, "What's your appraisal of the impact of the state law that we had gotten passed here in Kentucky?"
That is going to require that state officials certify before state can grant a construction permit that the incineration is the safest technology for destroying chemical weapons, and that no other technology is in place or under development that is available.
And he just looked at the guy and he said, it's a showstopper.
It could potentially become a showstopper at that site.
And I just sat there and I was like, we got him.
Also during this time in 1989, Common Ground, a second citizens organization, this one founded by Williams, hosted the first International Citizens Conference on Chemical Weapons Disposal. The conference brought to Richmond representatives from all eight U.S. disposal sites, as well as delegates from sites in Russia and in the Pacific Islands where incineration had already been underway. They drafted and signed what became known as the Citizens Accords. Craig Williams.
And what it did is it spelled out the principles under which we as a coalition were joined by 100 and some odd other groups across the country that adopted that position as our position on how to safely go about this. It's important to understand we were always in favor of disposal of this material. But it was just a question of how do you do it in a way that prioritizes the environmental protection and public health protection while you're doing it. In fact, the Chemical Weapons Working Group, which was the second stage of Common Ground, was instrumental in getting the Senate to ratify the Chemical Weapons Convention, which is the international treaty which bans the production and use of this material. So we were able to demonstrate our commitment to the disarmament side of this thing while still prioritizing our own parochial interests in all of these various locations.
This was a start, but more was needed. And in 1991, Hilly and Williams founded the Kentucky Environmental Foundation, chaired by Hilly with Williams as director.
It became a question of forming a nonprofit organization that could spearhead and lead the coalition that was formed in order to be able to raise funds in an appropriate manner to facilitate our objectives.
In that same year, 91, the foundation invited people living near those other chemical weapon sites in the U.S., Pacific, and Russia to join in forming a Chemical Weapons Working Group Coalition. Williams and other working group organizers visited all eight sites across the U.S. and three in Russia. So here we have the United States and the recently transitioned Soviet Union back to Russia. Mortal enemies on a political level, but when you interacted with people on the ground in Russia, what did you find?
Well, we found people are people, and they were equally concerned about their children as we were concerned about our children from a public health standpoint. It was very inspiring at the time because the Soviet Union had just initially disbanded, and it was the Russian Federation at that point when we went over a couple times. And we were warmly welcomed by all the communities. We were even warmly welcomed by the military at these various sites. And some of these sites were very remote, where we'd go and we would be the first Americans, the first Easterners that had been to some of these communities. So we were kind of like unique in our being there. And of course, it galvanized support over there, which eventually led to the Russian Ministry of Defense basically abandoning the incineration program over there, and they went to a neutralization-based program as well.
The Chemical Weapons Convention, banning the development, production, acquisition, stockpiling, retention, transfer, or use of chemical weapons, was opened for signature in Paris in January 1993, and within the first 2 days, 130 nations had signed. 4 years later, the United States committed. If you'd like to get down into the details of the agreement, you can find a copy of it on our homepage at esweku.org. It came up in my conversation with Craig Williams. Tell us about that agreement. How was it brought about, and how many nations are signatories?
Well, it started, there was some discussions and negotiations and agreements made between the then Soviet Union and the United States regarding the disposition of chemical weapons prior to the Chemical Weapons Convention, which is the current treaty under which we're obligated as our 190 countries There's only four outlier countries right now that are not party to this international treaty to dispose of, not manufacture and not export chemical warfare material. And 190 countries are now party to that treaty.
Those four outlier countries are Egypt, South Sudan, and North Korea, which had refused to sign, and Israel, which has signed but not ratified the agreement. Although the treaty did take effect in Syria in 2013, researchers have documented confirmed chemical weapons attacks in that country between 2012 and 2019, 98% of them attributed to the Assad regime. Williams was selected in 2006 by an international jury to receive the prestigious Goldman Environmental Prize for his efforts to convince the Pentagon to stop the Army's incineration plan. It was recognition of exhausting work. By now, Williams needed to focus less on managing a staff and fundraising and more on the chemical weapons issue itself. So in 2007, Elizabeth Crow succeeded Williams as director of the Kentucky Environmental Foundation.
So when I heard about the incineration plan, it just sounded like a bad idea. Why anyone would take a chemical that had been designed to kill people and put that through an incinerator where it could be emitted, however unintentionally, through a smokestack and affect a local population, just seemed a little crazy.
Jumping back in our timeline just a bit, the Army still had not been budging from its original plan to incinerate. So as Craig Williams recalls it,
Senator McConnell and others in Washington got legislation passed that required the Army to identify and demonstrate not less than six alternatives to incineration for the disposal of chemical weapons, and that law also included a prohibition on any furtherance of incineration processes in Colorado and Kentucky. So at that point, the Army was forced to look at, to take a serious look at, because they had already done their own internal studies on alternatives, and to no one's surprise, they decided that there was no other way to do it. And so the legislation stood up what they call the AQUA program, the Assembled Chemical Weapons Alternatives Program within the United States Army, overseen by the Pentagon. And that is the program that eventually led to the authority and agency of destroying these chemical weapons in both Richmond and Pueblo, Colorado.
The Assembled Chemical Weapons Alternatives Program, or AQUA, the U.S. Army office responsible for executing the mission of safely destroying the chemical weapons at the depot, has been led by Dr. Candace Coyle.
My job and my team's job is to oversight and make sure that the administration of the contract, the work is meeting the government's expectations, that it's being done safe and correctly, and here to assist on anything that we need to make sure that our headquarters is aware of things that need to be done here on the ground.
AQUA had a mandate to identify and demonstrate at least two alternatives to incineration. One option, supercritical water oxidation, or SQO, seemed promising. $1 million unit was installed at the depot. But there were problems. Craig Williams.
Well, it was abandoned because after it was erected at the site and it had undergone engineering and testing at its development location out in California, when they implemented it here and they ran the traps on how to, you know, is it going to work? They used simulant, not agent, to test it. There were some technical difficulties with the process. Because of the obligations under the congressional mandate and the international treaty to get this job done by a specific date, the Army made the decision and the community agreed that there was not adequate time to go back and try and figure out how to make this thing work as designed and still meet our obligations. At that point, it was decided that it would be abandoned and that the residue from the neutralization process called hydrolysate, which, by the way, is agent-free, would be shipped off-site to a toxic substances controlled disposal facility off-site from Richmond. And that's where it's going right now.
AQUA site project manager Candace Coyle.
The thing about Bluegrass is that we are what we call a first-of-a-kind pilot plant. That's why we have pilot plant in our title. And we tried a lot of new technologies here. SQUO had been a proven technology on a smaller scale, and it was being redeveloped to hit a larger scale production as well as for demilitarization purposes, which it had not done before. We found in the early systemization testing of that it wouldn't suit the program's requirements, and we ran into some challenges and made the decision that it was too high risk to proceed in that fashion. So we ended up going with a different alternative. We had to work very closely with the Citizens Advisory Committee and with Craig Williams and made sure that everyone understood the reasons that we chose to go that route. And that is where we've landed with that. So we were able to get a very good consensus that this was the best profile for lowering risk for personnel from a safety perspective to be able to meet what we needed to do for the program.
Meanwhile, what becomes of that SQUO technology?
It has been identified by the National Academy of Sciences and others to be very applicable for the destruction of PFAS.
At least one company has expressed interest, Craig Williams.
This corporation that's interested in doing this has discussed it with myself and as a community member and representing other members of the community, et cetera, as to if they come down and if it passes the surrogate testing, would it be appropriate for them to use these units where they stand? And the answer to that from the community side has been no. We do not want Richmond, Kentucky, Central Kentucky, to become a reception site for PFAS, hazardous waste, coming in here for the next 20 years, particularly since Kentucky has very little PFAS that's available for destruction, whereas some communities around the country have vast amounts of this stuff. So it's much more practical to move the units to where the majority of the PFAS is than to transport it all around the country into one location, particularly since we have a history in Richmond and Madison County and Central Kentucky of being very cautious when it comes to hazardous waste disposal, both on the heels of the chemical weapons issue, as well as fracking and pipelines and other sorts of activities that are associated with hazardous waste and potential accidents.
And there's red tape. April Webb, Hazardous Waste Branch Manager at the Kentucky Department for Environmental Protection.
There has to be an agreement between the Department of Defense and the governor that it's okay for them to reuse any piece of that facility before it can actually be reused. RCRA, Resource Conservation Recovery Act, requires for clean closure, requires everything to be demolished. So this would be a little bit of an exception to what we would call for normal clean closure of a facility that was closed.
The systems contractor Bechtel Parsons, working under the oversight of Candace Coyle's Aqua team, was tasked with constructing, operating, and closing the weapons destruction operation. Construction got underway in 2006 with Ron Hink as project manager.
I actually started the work in the chemical demilitarization program back on the Aberdeen, Maryland project, where we were destroying ton containers of mustard. Went through the design operation and decommissioning of that facility, had a little gap, and then got on this program. So it's one of those programs that gets in your blood and kind of keeps pulling you back.
With the destruction of the last of the chemical weapons on July 7th of this year, Bluegrass Army Depot had met the terms of the treaty.
We don't have any more munitions here.
Aqua Site Project Manager Candace Coyle.
Our requirement for treaty and the Chemical Weapons Convention was to make sure that the munition could not be used as intended. So by demating the rocket warhead from the rocket motor, draining the agent from the warhead, we've destroyed the munition. So we made our U.S. obligation to destroy all of the munitions in the chemical stockpile.
Earlier this month, inspectors from the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons did a final stockpile inspection at the depot. They verified that no chemical agent munitions remain in storage. Dr. Coyle will soon clear her desk at Aqua's Richmond offices.
So Aqua has always been what we call a sunset program. It was intended for a mission, and once the mission's done, we would disband and no longer exist. So we've been working ourselves out of a job for a very long time, and that's what ends up happening with the program. The program will be terminated at that point.
And that point comes in another 3 to 4 years. In the interim, Shannon Pendergrass steps into the AQUA leadership role, but this is not an end to COIL's career in ridding the Earth of these weapons of mass destruction.
I was presented with an opportunity to serve as the intra-agency liaison officer between the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, or OPCW, who oversees the Chemical Weapons Convention, and the AQUA program in coordination with the Defense Department. So I'll be serving the U.S. ambassador who serves at the OPCW, and I'll be helping with not just AQUA, but on defense topics with regards to interests and equities as the Chemical Weapons Convention moves into its next phases of interest per that multilateral decision and treaty agreement.
Coming up after the break, there still is waste to deal with at the depot.
We know we are still dealing with contaminated agent, potentially contaminated pieces of waste.
There are rumors to dispel.
Now, I want to make it clear, and everybody needs to understand, that the Bluegrass Army Depot is not going away.
And a powerful reminder that you don't have to resort to violence to move a mountain, in this case, the U.S. Army. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is WEKU Arts reporter Sherry Lawson with coming events and artist opportunities provided by the Kentucky Arts Council. Frankfurt's Josephine Sculpture Park and the Lexington Philharmonic invite you to a symphonic stroll 4 to 8 p.m. September 9th at the park. To purchase tickets, visit lexphil.org. And to learn more about the Sculpture Park, visit josephinesculpturepark.org. On September 1st, from 5 to 7 p.m., Gateway Regional Arts Center in Mount Sterling will host a free opening reception for artwork created by members of the Gate City Arts Guild. The artwork will be on exhibit through the end of September. For more information, visit grackentucky.org. And Richmond Area Arts Council is offering ballroom dance classes beginning September 11th, running through October 30th. For more information and to register, call 859-624-4242. I'm Sherry Lawson. Now back to this special edition of Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Picking up our story about the destruction of the chemical weapons that had been stored for many decades at the Bluegrass Army Depot near Richmond, the process of getting rid of these lethal gases has been completed. Craig Williams.
Initially, the resulting material from the neutralization process, which is called hydrolysate, was going to be processed on site in Kentucky through a technology that did not pass the engineering testing with surrogate during its testing at the facility. In Colorado, their secondary treatment process, called biodegradation, did pass the engineering phase, and that's what they're using for their disposal of their hydrolysate. It's important to understand Colorado had only mustard agent, which made their effort a lot simpler than ours. We have three kinds of agent and four different kinds of munitions that are explosively configured. It's a very complicated stockpile. So what's happened now is they have abandoned the secondary treatment process in Richmond, which is supercritical water oxidation. And that material, the hydrolysate, is now being shipped to a toxic substances controlled facility for disposal post-neutralization in Richmond.
The hydrolysate from Kentucky is shipped to a facility near Port Arthur, Texas, for incineration. Opponents of incineration are unhappy with this disposal method, but because of treaty requirements, incineration is the only option. There's more to be done. My question for Bechtel Parsons Bluegrass Project Manager Ron Hink. As of July 7th, all the chemical weapons at the Bluegrass Army Depot had been destroyed. Can you describe what remains to be processed? How dangerous are the remaining warheads and other materials, and how are they being disposed of?
Yeah, so what we did is the biggest hazard was, of course, the agent, GBNVX, that was in those weapons. We drained those, but there is a residual that can remain in those warheads. We overpacked those in a large can and crimped it tight. So that's what's remaining, is a drained warhead in these cans. Those cans are currently stored in the igloos, and we will bring those back into a static detonation chamber. They will be heated back up over 1,000 degrees. They will deflagrate, or basically the explosives that remain in the igniter portion, or burster portion, if you will, of that warhead, will detonate. It'll generate even more heat. That heat will destroy the remaining agent. And what comes out of that process is basically scrap metal.
All of the rocket warheads have now been drained, packed into the containers Hink talked about, and returned to temporary storage at the depot. The warhead containers are now being transferred from storage in batches to be destroyed in a static detonation chamber. The project's second static detonation chamber will come online later this year to destroy the containerized rocket warheads contaminated with VX nerve agent. All of those are expected to be gone by the end of 2024. That leaves the rocket motors. According to Aqua's Candace Coyle, those have been shipped to Anniston, Alabama.
For the rocket motors, they are being destroyed by deflagration, which is what happens in a static detonation chamber down at the static detonation chamber at Anniston. So it would be the same capability we have here. We're just, because of the workload, shipping it down to Anniston. Anniston had its own stockpile at one point. So that was the first static detonation chamber, I believe, the program used. So we are taking advantage of that infrastructure and shipping it down there to expedite processing. So that's how the rocket motors are destroyed, similar to what we do here.
All of this is dangerous work. In talking with Ron Hink, I brought up his report on worker safety. You reported at the end of April that the project had completed over 11 million hours and 1,325 days without a lost time accident. And it's clear there's a very strong safety culture at the plant. How do you achieve that level of success?
It is a remarkable record, especially when you consider the hazard that the workers face, and also point out the fact that we really never stopped building to accommodate the program. So heavy construction, hazardous operations, and we're at a safety performance that's comparable to people working in financial institutions. So it's a stark contrast when you look at it. But you do that with a lot of training, a lot of focus. When someone gets uncomfortable, we have a stop work authority. Any worker at any time can basically say, I don't understand this. I'm uncomfortable with this. I want to pause or stop work. And that stop work is absolutely honored. And then you step back, take a look at what's going on, and make sure it's executed safely and our workforce is always comfortable with what's being asked of them. So basically, we tell them that, but more importantly, we do that. So if they have a concern, we will stop. Schedule is important to us. Production is important. Safety is the most important aspect that we communicate to our workforce.
As we've said, it's not over yet. April Webb with Hazardous Waste at the Kentucky Department for Environmental Protection.
We're looking at 2027 for closure to be finished. So we've still got quite a few years before we get to that end point.
And after 2027, Madison County Judge Executive Reagan Taylor.
Now, I want to make it clear, and everybody needs to understand, that the Bluegrass Army Depot is not going away. The chemical weapons will be completely destroyed, and that demil process will be going away, which is a lot of jobs. And so from a financial position for the county, I think if there's anything that gives me concern, it's that.
While it has meant living in close proximity to a huge cache of aging lethal chemical weapons, Madison County has benefited. The communities across the country where stockpiles have been located have been receiving funding from FEMA's Chemical Stockpile Emergency Preparedness, or CSEP, program, and have been recognized nationally for their abilities to respond to emergencies of all kinds. Again, Judge Executive Reagan Taylor.
The CSEP program has been around, we could say, almost two generations, right? what do they say, a generation, it's about every 18 years. And so really and truly, it's created a standard to taxpayers in Madison County that they haven't really had to pay for, right? I mean, from us paying for it at a local level, it's been something that the federal government, you know, FEMA, the Army has paid for us for over 30 years. I mean, it's created this standard. And so one of the toughest challenges is going to be is, hey, we're used to these things. We expect these things. I'll say citizens deserve these things. But how are we going to pay for it? And that's some of the things that we're trying to figure out over the next couple of years before CSEP ends.
And there is lots to sort out for that future tighter budget.
You know, being able to afford, you know, an 800 megahertz radio system that is somewhere around a $20 million cost. And when we have to replace that in 20 years, I'm sure the price tag on it's not going to be $20 million anymore. I'm sure it's going to be more. I mean, all the fire trucks, the vehicle equipment, the message boards and security lighting and just the numerous things that the CSEP program has funded for our counties and our cities, that's going to be on the citizens' dime in the future. And when I say the citizens' dime, it's going to be on the 95,000 or less citizens' dime. What do we have, 350 million people in the United States? Well, for 30 years, the CSEP program has been funded, in a sense, by 350 million people instead of just 95,000. So it's getting ready to be on the Madison County's dime, and so that's a challenge. I mean, that's something that Madison County taxpayers need to understand.
A DEPO layoff aversion study published in 2013 states that an abrupt loss of the 1,500 jobs connected to this project will have a negative impact on the community. The skills required by most of these jobs, many of them highly specialized, are much in demand. We're going more in-depth into the economic implications for Madison County and the region in Episode 3 of this series. And next week, Crystal Jones and Shepard Snyder will be here to focus on those employees. How many will stay? How many will leave? My question for Bechtel Parsons Project Manager Ron Hink. I know that a lot of people there have been working together for a lot of years, and I'm sure, you know, families have grown, roots have been established, and so forth. So it's probably difficult to think about leaving the area. Do you think that those factors will play into people looking to stay put, to stick around in Madison County?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a nice community, and most folks are really comfortable here. And yeah, they've been here a while, so this is kind of home to them. So, and another thing is, like you mentioned, a lot of people have traveled with this program, worked multiple locations, multiple facilities around the country, but this is the end. So they've got to jump off this train at some point. There's a fair number that will retire. This has been their career. And there's others that will look to opportunities in the community. And this is a good community. There is a good, strong foundation here for future opportunities. And it's a highly skilled workforce, clear background. These folks are hard to find, so they'll be attractive for a lot of companies to look at that are, you know, setting up in this community.
The real heroes of the narrative here has been the workforce.
Aqua's Candace Coyle.
I was fortunate enough to play a very small role in the legacy that's going to be this historic mission that the U.S. has just completed. I often say that it was the right place, the right time, but this was the right team the entire time. And I think that's the one thing that I've learned is that this team has always been the team to get it done. There's never been a way where ego has gotten in the way. We have a lot of partners and we all work together. We had one team, one mission mentality, you know, from the state regulators, from KDEP to, you know, local officials, to the community itself, Craig Williams, you know, Reagan Taylor, everybody that's been a part of that, KDEP, looking at Bluegrass Army Depot and looking at the Bluegrass chemical activity. Of course, we could not have done it without any of these folks. So I think that's the one thing I've learned is that this level of teamwork that was required to get this mission done was not an insignificant factor, but we had all the right people here the entire time. And I think that made my job a lot easier than it could have been.
There is another hero in this story, grassroots democracy. People who most often disagree with each other's worldview, finding themselves in the odd position of simply agreeing. Take the relationship between Craig Williams and Senator Mitch McConnell.
You know, Mitch and I don't see eye to eye on a lot of things. And he'll be the first to say that, and I'll second that emotion. But on this project, he has responded in a way that is lockstep with the sentiment and the needs of the community. He has backed our position on safe disposal ever since he was convinced in 1996 that we were correct in our position. And once he staked out that position on his own after our engagement with him over many years, he has doggedly pursued the best interests of the community and stood up to the Pentagon. In Secretary Gates's memoir, he mentions how Senator McConnell was always hounding him about this chemical weapons situation in Madison County. I mean, he's been on it the whole time, and since he, quote, found religion on it in 1996, he's been a very strong ally of ours, and he remains such to this day. I actually look forward to his being at the ceremony in October. So we can mutually congratulate each other on what's been a very long haul. And not only has he talked the talk, but he's walked the walk on this issue.
I think it even goes up to a higher level.
Again, Aqua Project Manager Candace Coyle.
You have 193 state parties that participate in the Chemical Weapons Convention, and everyone has agreed that this is not the right way to go about any kind of warfare. So it's a great win for, you know, bluegrass. It's a great win for the U.S., but I think it's just a great win for the human race as a whole for agreeing on something and recognizing the dangers of it and working together to eradicate it.
And says Coyle, and as Craig Williams mentioned, plans are in the works for a big celebration this fall.
Yes. So that event is on October 11th at 11 o'clock at the Armed Forces Reserve Center, right at the front gate of Bluegrass Army Depot. I will happily be hosting that as the former site project manager because I'll be stepping down at the end of the month. But it's going to be a celebration with the public. Everyone should come, bring their families. We really want the public to be there. I mean, this has been a win for every one of us, and everybody played a role in it. We should have a lot of great folks there. We have the Madison County High School Choirs performing. They won't let me audition. I'm a little too old, but we'll have a lot of great folks participating, and we're hoping it's just going to be a great celebration of what has been done here in Richmond.
As we worked on this story in today's very divisive atmosphere, we wondered, how did Craig Williams, recipient of one of the world's most prestigious environmental awards, win the confidence and support of so many powerful people, among them some who definitely did not share his political views?
You have to identify people who can help you that are in positions of influence, and don't burn bridges. You have to be respectful, you have to be considerate, you have to be accurate, and you have to be passionate.
Is that all? No, there's more.
You have to be focused, and you have to be accurate at all times. In 39 years, I've never given Senator McConnell or our other elected officials reason for doubt of what I've told them are the circumstances and the facts associated with this issue. And that kind of confidence that they've built in me and my organization translates into action on their behalf because they don't have any doubts. So the worst thing community organizers can do is go out into the community, meet with the media, and start spouting off things that they can't back up. The mantra I've always said from the get-go in the Chemical Weapons Working Group Coalition is, if you can't prove it, don't say it.
One of the first things that comes to mind when you hear the story of a town in Kentucky taking on the mighty Department of Defense in Washington is the biblical story of David and Goliath. But is that the appropriate metaphor? Special Topics reporter Chris Begley.
A group of concerned citizens takes on the Pentagon and wins. This looks like a classic David versus Goliath story.
When we describe something in that way, we usually mean a situation where the underdog wins, where the little person overcomes the odds. And I guess that's true here. But David versus Goliath stories have other meanings, too, and I think they fit this situation just as well. In many versions of that story, David uses a sling and defeats Goliath and his mighty sword, or maybe a spear. For anyone living in that time and place in the Middle East 2,000 years ago, the meaning of that story would have been very different. A sling was a hunting weapon and a weapon of war. They could kill or disable people from a distance. It's hard to imagine how anybody with a spear or a sword, no matter how strong or how good they were, could get close enough to somebody with a sling to even use their weapons. Goliath brought a knife to a gunfight. When I see what happened here, when the military showed up to explain to the community what they were about to do, they seemed completely unprepared for what was about to happen. They didn't expect the pushback, and you can see it in their response when they're scrambling for some way to explain or justify their plan. They miscalculated. They were not prepared for the slings. Another meaning of the David and Goliath story is that David was on the side of righteousness and good, and the Philistines, Goliath, were on the wrong side. In our story here, telling the hard truth and doing right by the community was ultimately victorious. But the thing that comes across to me from this story is that, ultimately, it's not really a David versus Goliath story at all, because David and Goliath here end up being allies and working towards the same goal. That's probably the only way anything really works. It was a rare coalition of political opponents that allowed this to work out the way it did. I think if we merely draw the standard David versus Goliath conclusion from this, we're missing the point. Now, there was some arm twisting at first, no doubt, but ultimately everybody got on the same side. There was consensus and cooperation, and it worked. In many ways, that's more inspiring than the underdog winning. The other important part of this story is the solidarity and organization of the various communities in similar situations. This allowed the truth to come out and provided the leverage that resulted in success. Without organization, you are a lone individual, without influence and without recognition of any kind. That's how John L. Lewis of the United Mine Workers of America put it, and I've always liked that. But I've never really liked the David versus Goliath stories. We always seem surprised when a small group of determined people manage to make big things happen. In the words of anthropologist Margaret Mead, "Never doubt a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has."
Thanks for joining us for part one of our three-part series about chemical weapons demolition at Bluegrass Army Depot, just a few miles from this radio station in Richmond. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Jean Marie Hibbard, senior producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Stu Johnson, Crystal Jones, and Shepard Snyder join me in conducting interviews for this series. And again, our thanks to the Kentucky Environmental Foundation and filmmaker Ben Evans for use of audio from the documentary Nerve. You can view the documentary in full. We posted that link on our homepage, esweku.org. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.